This week on Making Contact.
The sufferings of the land, it's all over the world. And if we don't combine ourselves, come together and fight this injustice, then we are going to suffer forever.
Concentrated ownership, overdevelopment, and skyrocketing values all are making land less and less accessible. These recent trends in agriculture have meant big changes, not just to small farmers in the U.S. In the developing world, farming is a constant struggle to survive. On this edition, we'll take a look at the challenges rural people face and the growing international movement to gain land rights. I'm Pauline Bartolone, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Millions of landless rural peasants live in miserable conditions around the world. In developing countries, many are stuck in a colonial ownership model, where a small elite hold the majority of the country's land. Landless workers are forced to sow someone else's property, as migrants are sharecroppers, with inadequate access to social services and no opportunities to escape poverty. The concentration of land in the hands of a few has historically been a problem in Africa. In Egypt, land reforms for the past 50 years have led to modest redistribution. But Karim Saber of the Land Center for Human Rights, an advocacy organization for farmers in Egypt, says his country is a long way from having a just agricultural model. During a speech at the 2005 World Social Forum, he described how recent economic policies have forced many farmers off their land.
Until the 80s, farmers used to plant the land and they didn't have many problems with the government or with the large landowners. But after the implementation of the World Bank strategies or plans for Egypt and the large corporations, more than 1 million Egyptian farmers have been evicted out of their lands. And the cost of rent of land increased by more than 13 times. And the struggle of the farmers or peasants of Egypt against the policies of the World Bank and the big corporations helped by the government is that they paid more than 100 farmers killed or martyrs in the course of the struggle.
لأن قوات البوليس في مصر كانت بتحبس الفلاحين اللي بيرفضوا الخروج من الأرض وكانت بيتم اعتقالهم.
They were forced out of their lands, and those who refused or objected were put away, of course, in prison and incarcerated.
السياسات الإصلاح أو ما سمي بسياسات في مصر بنسميها سياسات الإفقار للفلاحين.
Instead of land reform and agrarian reform, it's really impoverishment reform.
أدت إلى رفع القيمة الإيجارية إلى 13 ضعف القيمة الإيجارية.
Cost of land and cost of resources to work on the land have increased many fold.
أدت لنقص في الاكتفاء الذاتي من الغذاء بالنسبة للمصريين.
There is less self-sufficiency in agrarian produce for Egypt.
وفقد الفلاحين المصريين حوالي مليون ونص.
And the peasants have lost more than 1.5 million fadans or acres of agricultural land for building purposes.
وحتى الآن يعني من حوالي شهر ما زالت هذه السياسات.
And these policies are encouraged by the international corporations that supposedly aid the Egyptian government.
قرية في مصر تسمى قرية سرندو.
In one case, in the village of Sirendo recently, the farmers refused to be evicted from their land, refused to leave. So the army interfered and the government sent the armed forces to force the peasants out, and they put away many of them in prison and actually kicked them out of their land by force.
ورغم المبررات الكتير اللي بتقولها الحكومة المصرية ومن وراها المؤسسات الدولية.
And in spite of the claims of the international institutions and the Egyptian government, actually statistics and research has shown that the traditional peasants in Egypt produce more per plot of land than the big corporations. There are dozens of organizations defending the rights of peasants and farmers in Egypt and in their struggle to gain their rights. But such efforts need cooperation and coordination of all the similar forces in the world struggling for a better world and a different world.
شكرا على حسن استماعكم.
Thank you for your good listening.
That was Karam Saber of Egypt's Land Center for Human Rights. Agrarian reform programs sponsored by the World Bank have been a failure, according to international peasant movements. In Brazil, for example, the bank financed market-based reforms that introduced apply-by-mail and credit lending programs depended on the voluntary sale of property by large landowners. Both initiatives flopped. Poorly designed agrarian programs have left out the landless people themselves, says Sergio Saud of Brazil's Pastoral Lands Commission, a faith-based agrarian reform organization. At the 2005 World Social Forum, he said the problem lies at the fuzzy line between government and financial institutions.
A pergunta central é...
So a question that I have is, why is such a powerful institution like the World Bank suddenly concerned with a topic like agrarian reform?
Há várias razões.
There are several reasons.
Mas a retórica, ou seja, aquilo que eles nos dizem.
Now, one point important point has to do with the rhetorical aspects. What are they saying to who?
É que é para combater a pobreza.
It's clear that to combat poverty in developing countries, access to land is a fundamental issue, and they can't deny that.
Essa é a retórica. A prática, na verdade, é...
Now, the bank says that it's promoting policies to improve access to land, but what this rhetoric really does is it serves like a disguise for policies which are designed to promote markets in buying and selling land.
Bom, a pergunta é, o que fazer diante dessas políticas?
What can we do when we're faced with these market policies?
Eu pessoalmente acreditava, depois de 5 anos de governo FHC, em que os movimentos sociais...
So I believe that after 5 years of struggle by social movements against these policies, including in the previous government...
O governo Lula iria...
I mean, I believe then that after so many years of struggle in the Fernando Henrique government, that when the Lula government came in, it was going to stop these World Bank land market policies.
Ao contrário, o governo FHC...
But exactly the opposite happened. One of the first things that the Lula government did was to approve a big package of financing for 50,000 families through the land bank model, which is the World Bank model.
Mas o governo Lula decidiu ampliar esse...
And the Lula government decided to expand this financing, adding additional resources to use this model to supposedly address the needs of 130,000 families over 3 years.
O que nós tivemos como experiência de resistência às políticas do Banco Mundial,
we have a lot of experience resisting policies of the World Bank.
Foram em diferentes direções e, diria assim, espaços.
We did different kinds of resistance using different techniques and in different spaces.
Uma opção foi inclusive...
So, for example, at one point, we, after various discussions, we decided to try to challenge these policies from inside the World Bank through the World Bank's inspection panel.
Resumidamente, tentamos utilizar...
I mean, we were basing this on the World Bank's own stated supposed principles that all of their projects should reduce poverty, should combat corruption, should promote the autonomy of countries that are receiving funding.
E aí solicitamos painéis de inspeção e isso...
So it is true that when we filed the complaint with the inspection panel, there was a slight reduction in the intensity of these programs in Brazil.
Em outros termos, são...
So what we can conclude from those kind of inside mechanisms is they do have some effect, but very limited.
Em outras palavras, o que tem sido mais efetivo é...
So in other words, what we've found to be most effective, both in terms of political struggle as well as in terms of direct action.
E aqui no caso dos brasileiros, estou chovendo no molhado.
So our most effective means to challenge the methods and discourse of the World Bank has been to directly, through social struggle, seize land.
Para concluir, mesmo que essa tenha sido o nosso...
And we found that while the land occupation is the most important part of our struggle, we also have to confront the World Bank in what we might call the symbolic arena of struggle.
That was Sergio Saur of Brazil's Pastoral Lands Commission. We'll have more about agrarian reform in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast online at radioproject.org. Whether it's water, forests, loan agencies, or even government research, everything an agricultural worker depends on is becoming increasingly privatized. Because of the changes, farmers are under more pressure than ever to pay for social services. Peter Rosset is a researcher at the Institute for Change in the Mexican Countryside, a nonprofit farmer advocacy organization based in Oaxaca, Mexico. He's also former co-director of Food First, based in Oakland, California. We spoke with Rosset about the landless movements opposing privatization and the colonial ownership model in the developing world. He says rural farmers are now being pushed to a breaking point.
The land issue has a lot of dimensions that vary from different parts of the world, but definitely there is a major land issue or land question in all continents. So we can take a quick look in Latin America. Is the continent with the most inequitable distribution of land, where you have a small minority owning most of the land and then a large majority that's landless. And so the struggle for land reform in Latin America is to expropriate the large estates, which mostly were put together by stealing, not buying land from poor people. In Asia, there are some countries which have Latin American-style land distributions, like the Philippines, Indonesia, so the struggle there is similar to Latin America. Africa has some countries that are like Latin America, mostly the colony countries like South Africa, Zimbabwe, Kenya, and then other countries where there's still a lot of traditional communal land management systems, but they're being encroached upon by large export plantations of transnational corporations, and so... And in addition to the colonial elite landowning structure, which is still there, then there's also the squeezing of the whole production chain by the transnational corporations who monopolize buying and exporting agricultural products and therefore are able to impose lower and lower and lower prices on farmers or salaries on farm workers. And so that's one of the intensification factors, along with free trade policies, that have taken the already horrible, inequitable land distribution system, which already generated poverty and then squeezed people even more, basically to the breaking point where movements start growing very fast.
Rosset says market-led reforms swept the developing world during the 1990s, but have not managed to solve the problems caused by the concentration of land ownership. He says these reforms, sponsored by institutions like the World Bank, do not give farmers the support they need to obtain their own land.
We've done studies in Guatemala, in Indonesia, in Philippines, in Brazil, in South Africa, in Colombia, and in no cases do these symbolic programs provide enough credit for more than 1% of the landless population to actually acquire land. So by creating land markets, they're not helping poor people. They're helping rich people and corporations that want to accumulate more land. For example, in Thailand, communities that had secure access to what was theoretically public land, but that they farmed communally for more than 1,000 years, were told, now you're going to get your own individual titles. Isn't that great? You'll become landowners. Within 3 years after the communities got individual titles, which the bank told them would give them greater security of land tenure, they'd been forced to sell their land because it was right before the Asian financial crisis. Crop prices crashed, and they couldn't survive farming, and land that they had secure access to for 1,000 years. Communally, they lost in 3 years under this individual land titling, which is it's just another way of saying privatize the land, and then with economic distress conditions, people lose it from distress sales, or they get too indebted to the bank, they can't pay off the credit. Now that it's a private title, they've mortgaged it to get credit, the bank takes it away, then the bank auctions it, and then rich people get it.
Many countries have agrarian reform laws written into their constitutions, but as Rossett explains, the government's proverbial hands are tied to international institutions that hinder the reform process. He says because of government inaction, rural movements such as Brazil's MST, or Landless Workers Movement, have resorted to occupying privately owned land. By directly seizing plots and living on them until they're expropriated by the government, the movement says it is carrying out the redistribution process as laid out in Brazil's constitution.
And with this strategy, they've been able in 20 years to settle about 300,000 formerly landless families. We're talking about more than 1 million people on something like 20 million hectares of land. I mean, it's absolutely staggering, the proportion of what they've been able to do. It's like a whole small country that they've created inside the large country of Brazil, in which people who are the poorest of the poor, the most excluded from Brazilian society, people living in the favela slums, landless migratory farm workers in rural areas, homeless people, people with substance abuse problems, the most excluded, have organized themselves, cleaned up their lives, and become productive farming communities.
In the past couple of decades, social movements seeking agrarian reform have spread throughout the world. Rossett says these movements aren't just fighting the current economic model, but are standing for what they call food sovereignty.
Food sovereignty is a concept that was coined by the international peasant movement Via Campesina, and it's a holistic alternative model to the dominant model of agricultural development. The dominant model is agro-export, it's large production units, it's mechanization, it's free trade, it's GMOs, it's agrochemicals, it's excluding people and biodiversity from rural areas. There are many different aspects of the dominant model that are bad. And you can't just resolve all those problems, say, with just landform or with just ecological farming practices. Because it's many aspects of the model. At this point, what the social movements are saying is we need a different model. And the different model is food sovereignty. It means rather than putting the priority on agro-export, priority should be put on the national economy, the local economy, on producing food for people in countries where they're hungry people, instead of exporting all of the agricultural production and leaving people hungry. It means farmers should have the right to produce. That means you can't allow Cargill or Archer Daniels Midland to take their own local markets away from them with cheap subsidized produce flooding in. So it means no to free trade.
The problems associated with land concentration aren't confined to the developing world. Rossett says farmers in the U.S. and Europe are also struggling to remain competitive with agribusiness and face obstacles associated with rising land values.
I think the great unaddressed problem right now is land in developed countries in the north. You can't get access to land in the United States to become a farmer. If you're a young family or individual who wants to farm, you just take one look at land prices that have been driven up by speculation, and you can basically forget it. Dominant economic model in the U.S. is driving about 160,000 farmers a year into bankruptcy and off the land. In the European Economic Community, 200,000 farmers a year being driven off the land. Taxpayers in both Europe and the U.S. pay massive subsidies to agriculture, but it only goes to large corporate farms. 50% that are family farmers get nothing. About 10% of the farmers get 70% of the subsidies in both the U.S. and the EU. And something has got to change. If we don't have some kind of land reform, agrarian reform that takes into account the entire inequitable system of access to land, low prices to farmers, unfair subsidies that only go to the rich, we're not going to have any food and agriculture production left.
That was Peter Rossett of the Institute for Change in the Mexican Countryside and former co-director of Food First. During the Great Depression, Ben and Joe Francia of Sunnyvale, California, learned to farm in what was then known as the Valley of Heart's Delight. Now over 80 years of age, the brothers are the last remaining farmers in Silicon Valley. Surrounded by highway and the high-tech industry, they have resisted selling their plot of land in return for a comfortable retirement. In this excerpt of a short video documentary called Lawrence Station Road, produced by Adam Burgess, the Francia brothers explain why they would never give up their way of life.
We had to get up early in the morning. We had to wash turnips and green onions. We started peddling with bicycles to little stores. Come home with 50 cents or a dollar, you know. Mom, she put it in a little jar in the cupboard, and she says, well, this is what we're going to use for buying so many sacks of flour and whatever we need for the winter time. But we were poor. I mean, we were poor. I am a farmer from way, way back. Way back where? We've been farming since 1926 with my dad. At that time, it was depression days. You know, it was hard days. The land was cheap. People came around begging for if we could buy their land. You know, we were getting bigger and older, so we wanted to expand, right? So we bought this parcel of 20 acres down here in Santa Clara. At that time, when we bought that 65 years ago, it was just a little, it was better than $1,000 an acre. But right now, you can't even touch the dust for $1,000 an acre. It was brothers. We worked all our lives together. And Mom and Dad says when they were gone, they would wish that we would continue working together, which we are today. Ben at 81 and I'm 79 and we're still together. We get along good. When my father was farming, we worked as three, as one. Three, but one. My father did all the bossing, told us what to do, and we did as he said. My father passed away. I'm the oldest, and I'm next down the list. I give orders. They do what I say. I mean, we once in a while get in a little row, you know, but not boxing matches. You ever see these guys go in the bar? They get a shot of whiskey. What do? They feel like fighting the world, right? Because they're strong, because it's not them, but it's the booze that they drank. It's in their system. It makes them do a lot of crazy things. So commercial fertilizer is the same way. You give it a shot of commercial fertilizer, boosts the plant, but it's not good for the following year because the ground needs minerals. It needs fertilizing. Anything artificial, we don't believe in that. My dad was a firm believer in, you know, horse manure, cow manure, or whatever. And we used to use a lot of it until we got here. And we used to put yards and yards of loads of horse manure, cow manure, which we used to haul from Fremont. And we used to put it out here, and then it got to the point where people used to get a whiff of it. And the flies, and that kind of put the stop to it. I was married for 42 years. My wife passed away 20 years ago. If I stay home one day, I got just look at four walls. You know how it is when you're by yourself. You got nobody to talk to. I mean, I'd come with my brother. we talk, you know. And you come out here, you see a neighbor, you start talking to him. You see a customer that's been coming in here for years, you talk to him. And that's the way your day goes by.
This area was just all farmland. It was just all completely dairies and a lot of orchards. In fact, when orchards were in bloom, you can smell the bloom and blossoms, you know.
I used to farm 700 acres one time. Where is it at now? Now it's all homes and electronic buildings. The expressway was called Lawrence Station Road, and it was only a two-laner. And you used to see a car, maybe one or two cars, every in an hour. It's a different world altogether. I wish I was living in that world. I got a daughter, and she's married. She's got two boys, and they're all going to college. They don't even, you can't even talk to them about farming. They don't like it. But my daughter, my oldest daughter, she's got a big farm down in Chowchilla, down south. She's got an almond grove down there. Yeah.
What else there is to do when you get at our age? All we've been doing is farming. And that's, we love what we're doing. And that's why we continue. You just figure out, you've done a day's work and you wait for the next day and you go back at the same old thing and you're happy. When you work with dirt, it's the greatest thing a human being could do if you're a farmer.
Yeah, but I mean, I followed the pattern of younger people. I do the same thing. They live it up. I try to live it up too. But I was kind of, you know, wild in my younger days, you know. But I did a lot of work though. They tell us we're crazy to do what we're doing, because just the interest alone, we can live like kings. But no, we love what we're doing. Farmers from our heart, not farmers that just do it today and forget about it tomorrow.
That was an excerpt from Lawrence Station Road, a video documentary by Adam Burgess. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Emily Polk for production assistance. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production, funded primarily by generous gifts from people in the community. We are committed to providing a unique forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have ideas for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a CD copy of program number 0506, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Tina Rubio, senior producer. Justin Beck, producer. Dorian Taylor, communications manager. Esther Mania, outreach coordinator. Tom Evans, development associate. Emily Polk, production fellow. And I'm your host, Pauline Bartoloni. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
And you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon. The time is about half a minute after 11 a.m. Time now for Democracy Now!
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Doha, Qatar.
Our offensive against terror involves more than military action.